Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
With that good morning, let's discuss some rather ominous topics. But appropriate, not necessarily for Rosh Chodesh, but for Av. As a faith community, we often, almost always, look to our sacred texts to help us understand the contemporary scene. So, for example, if something were absolutely joyous to take place, we might identify that as a Purim Katan, a Purim Katan, which actually there is a siman in Shulchan Aruch. It's actually a very large section in the Chaye Adam of exactly how to memorialize a very nice event as something that happened to Mordechai and Esther millennia ago. If something terrible were to strike, well, say like the Crusades, then we would memorialize that in the form of a kina, perhaps, which is what we do on Tisha B'Av. We absorb our historical memories. This is something made well known by the historian Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi. We memorialize the good times and the bad times within a biblical framework. That's how our calendar moved. Therefore, there was much commotion about innovating both Yom HaShoah and Yom HaAtzmaut. What gives us the right in the 20th century to say that the Holocaust is any worse or should be treated any differently? In terms of numbers, obviously, far surpasses anything we've ever known in Jewish history. But nevertheless, on a theological, on a halachic plane, what gives us the right to understand the Holocaust as a Yom HaShoah separate than any other tragedy that has befallen that is absorbed into Tisha B'Av? Likewise, what privileges us the opportunity to consecrate a Yom HaAtzmaut or a Yom Yerushalayim when other holidays have somehow been inserted within, say, a Pesach, a Passover, or a Purim, are holidays of great joy? And that's an interesting discussion of how that came to be. But others have discussed it. What I want our business this morning, we only have a short time to do it, is not to look at the calendar, but look at categories of evil. Rather gruesome, but I think it'll be helpful. How do our rabbinic writers, how does our heritage understand our caricature enemies? How do we understand the icons of evil, of doom, that really loom larger than all the others? So, title of the lecture, Amalek and Egel, A Contrast in Evils. Are there any other types of evil? Any other forms, images that have been bestowed upon us by the Torah? Any larger than these two? Any other examples? Any possibilities?
Esav.
Excuse me? Esav, sure, and Edom, and how that was assigned to Christianity and then to a certain breed of secularism. Absolutely, there's a great, interesting historical reception to that. So Esav and Edom, for sure. Anything else?
Lavan.
Excuse me?
Lavan.
Lavan, right, in the Haggadah, obviously has a place in how to understand him. Interesting that he hasn't been used as much as the others. Unfortunately, there were worse people who came after him, perhaps.
Sodom.
Sodom, very often, and that's a topic that we'll stay away from. But yes, that obviously has its own archetypes. The egg is our business this morning. Absolutely, I agree with you.
What about even the flood? There was such
a Mabel, Dor HaMabel, Dor HaFlaga, Paro, Ve'yakam Melech Hadash, has an interesting rhetorical history. Absolutely.
Seems enough. Sorry?
Yeah, it's a recording.
It's recording?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so there are different models, but let's just assume for our purposes today that a malek and ego are the two major forms of evil. And what I want to do this morning is to look how rabbinic writers, and when I say rabbinic writers, this isn't just rabbis and scribes, but it's actually how communal memory is formed over time. And how these two types, ego and a malek, have been used, and let's see if we can demarcate a trend. Understand, is there a phenomenon? Is there a sorting pattern which this type of evil becomes ego? This other type of evildoer, well, that's an amalek. And from understanding that, those paradigms perhaps, we'll have a better understanding about how Jewish history and Jewish community have understood Egel and Amalek, both retrojecting into the Torah and over the course of time. Its usefulness and its reception over the course of Jewish history. And this is not an exhaustive study, it's quite a bit, but let's see how much we can get through. So first and foremost, source one is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Ein lecha kol paraniot uparaniot shebal olam. There isn't a single punishment that arrives into this world. She'ein ba echad me'esrim v'arba behechra litra, at 1/24th of some measure. Shel egel harishon. All punishment comes into the world as a smidgen of a connection to the Egel HaZahav. So already you can see that the Talmud takes its Egel business quite seriously, and all evil and all punishment has something to do with Egel HaZahav. Tragedy and iniquity, and yeah, I'm collapsing the two. Okay. Interesting. So paraniot in rabbinic parlance is very often attached to why does one... correct. Paraniot in its literal interpretation is a tragedy. Usually it is connected, but I understood. Okay, point taken. We'll separate the two. I have no problem with that. Thank you very much for the clarification. Mashal amad davar doma, the Medrash Tanchuma in source 2. This is the earliest rabbinic source we have about a malek. It's well known. It's quoted most famously by Rashi. To an ambati rotechet shelo haya bri yecholo liyarei betocha. It's like a scolding bath in which a person simply just cannot tolerate, would jump out immediately. Ba ben Baliel, this one misfit, this one grotesque creature. Kafetz v'yarei letocha. Even though this one person, this one item, this one no goodnik, this nasty nunnik, would get burned terribly, he jumped in. Even though he himself was pained terribly, he kira lifnei acherim. He cooled it for everybody else. His temperature cooled down the scalding bath water, and so everybody else could jump into the bath. That is a famous mashal, an allegory, that once a malek was the first to attack the Jewish people after Har Sinai. It seemed before then they were untouchable. Who would touch the Jewish people? Ma'amad Har Sinai. You have lightning, you have thunder, you have tablets. Not going to touch them. Come a malek and say, we can do it. We're going to set a precedent. So everybody else would follow. So they both have very strong rabbinic traditions. So I want to review first Egel HaZahav. This is from one of the earliest and still widely used sources, Rabbi Dov Katz's Tenuat HaMusar. And you see the citation here. Speaking about Rabbi Simcha Zissel, one of the leading students of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement. Beutel Begermania. I give you the translation. Maybe we'll just summarize and get to the punchline. Rabbi Simcha Zissel wanted to establish a day school in Grobna. He wanted to establish a Hillel Torah, an Ari Crown. Actually, we do know. It was more like Hillel Torah than Ari Crown. And he asked his teacher, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, for permission. In his way of thinking, nobody had ever tried such a thing. They would have to assuage the concerns of the Russian government. They would have to introduce certain studies, Russian literature, mathematics, things that, from a traditionalist point of view, might not have seemed altogether appropriate for young boys and girls. So he asked Rav Simcha Zissel, did Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Pam Sha'al Et, I'm in the bolded section in source 3, two lines from the bottom, Pam Sha'al Et, Rav Simcha Zissel, Im Hu Yodea, She'ilu Tzeit Miza Egel. Must have been shocked. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter asked him, did you think? Are you a little bit scared? Do you know what you're doing? Do you know that you may, from this operation, this enterprise, what come about might be an Egel HaZahav? V'acharei shekibel mimenu tshuva. And after he answered in the affirmative, did Rav Simcha Zissel, yeah, yes, Rebbe. I understand that I'm playing with fire, that what might come out of this is an Egel HaZahav. Interesting use of language. And afterwards, you see in the sources, it was Kedaihu Lismoch Alav. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, if you understand what you're doing can be harmful. What you're doing, now, again, this is from a different point of view. My point is not necessarily to make you agree with the conditions in the situation, the historical context, but understand the language. Rabbi Simcha Zissel asks his teacher, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rebbe, can I please have your askama? Can I have your approbation? Can I write in all the newspapers that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter supports my educational initiatives? Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had one question. Do you understand the gravity, the perilousness of your operation? Are you going to understand this may be an Egel HaZahav? So in that way, why is he using Egel HaZahav? What does Egel HaZahav mean to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter? And we actually have the primary sources which speak to this. So we do know, pretty sure, that historically Rabbi Yisrael Salanter did in fact contend that this might be an Egel HaZahav. Okay, so what's an Egel HaZahav according to the source? What does it seem to be?
Maybe they're afraid that they will become less religious.
Sure, that is the concern, but why employ the image of Egel HaZahav? Yes?
Because they may look at other subjects or areas they're looking at, go in that direction and see those as false idols.
So let's go back to the Egel HaZahav. What is the sin? What is the problem, the grave error of Maase Egel? What is it? What was the Egel HaZahav? Moshe was on Har Sinai, was doing his divine thing in heaven, and the Jewish people were growing nervous for a variety of reasons. They had miscalculated his time up there in the clouds, and they therefore pushed Aaron HaKohen, right? Story's familiar?
They organized themselves.
And what was Egel HaZahav supposed to be?
An intermediary.
It wasn't a substitute for God. It was a substitute for
Moshe.
It was done with a certain level of earnestness, but backfired terribly. It was to employ, with somewhat good cause, a disastrous mechanism that had absolutely grievous impact. Absolutely. It was coming from a place of, are you really sure you're doing what you think you're doing? Well, not so fast. Well, in the 19th century, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter proffered that to his Talmid, to Rabbi Simcha Zissel. Is this going to be an Egel HaZahav? Have you thought about it? Is this really going to be the most authentically, Jewishly educational operation you can possibly muster? Well, think twice about it. And as long as you've thought twice about it, then I trust your instincts. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says to his leading pupil. Okay, so that's one example. Let's see if the trend follows. Tshuva, unpublished Tshuva. We only have the English translation from a very important book by Professor Eli Lederhandler, Jewish Responses to Modernity, a wonderful professor at Hebrew University. He reproduced in a text the following Tshuva. I received your letter today. I'm in source 4. And I am responding in the matter of the new Maschinen. That's German or Yiddish for machine. That have been invented to roll the matzahs. And your query whether it is permissible to bake Passover matzahs on these machines. Even though the machine has been modified since my last response on the matter, when all the great rabbinical authorities raised their voices against it, nevertheless, although the intention of those who modified the machine was to eliminate the problem, in the process, they have violated other prohibitions and raised other doubts. Stop here for a second. So what's happening? A tshuva from the late 19th century. What's the concern? What do we get so far out of it? This is a very agitated rabbinic writer who has been asked repeatedly, at least the second time, about a new halachic innovation. What is it? It is a machine matzah maker. Absolutely. It is a, it can't be a conveyor belt because Henry Ford would be too young to have done it at this point. But it is some sort of machine processed matzah which introduced new forms. What might be the problem with machine matzah? It'll pass the time. It will not grab all the dough, and therefore it'll be machmitz. It'll be chimutz. It'll rise. Absolutely. If it's not cleaned well enough, it doesn't have necessarily both the authenticity and the guarantees of handmade matzah. It's also something new. Religion is oftentimes allergic to new. So let's continue. So and now, apparently in this rabbinic writer's mind, you come to me and you tell me that they perfected the machine a little bit more. No, you don't understand. He doesn't provide us the details. You think they fixed it? Nah, they've introduced more errors to the process. Therefore, I'll skip down to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines from the bottom. Therefore, it is incumbent upon all the leaders of the generation to step into the breach. I can only reiterate what I wrote in my letter to Kravenchug, although my words contained no new point of law, so I'm not saying anything new. I'm just repeating, rehashing exactly what I said the last time. They were written with great sincerity and found their way to the hearts of those who faithfully keep the law of Israel. I thought I destroyed the issue. I eradicated the problem the last time. I'm getting a headache listening to the fact that I have to do it all over again. I'm not going to say anything new. I'm going to repeat myself, and hopefully this time the machine matzah will die. So they will all band, so that they all banded together and resolved to banish this golden calf, this Egel HaZahav, the device from Kremenchug. For it is a creation of the evil inclination. Okay, it's another image, the Yetzirah, and its infernal machinations. Is this consistent? Is this the same image of Egel HaZahav? Is this the same category? What are your thoughts?
They think they're making doing a mitzvah easier, but in fact, there are things that could be making it harder than just break it up for Pesach.
They think they're doing something good, but they're not. Okay. That seems very similar. Anybody else?
how can they compare it? I mean, you know, Eliel Azahar was, first of all, lack of leadership, and really Avot Azar, I mean, extreme. So how can they compare this small thing? Seems to me, I don't know.
Okay, so you think the volume might be a little much? Again, we're all it's also the in the late 19th century is when the Haskalah really in earnest reached Eastern Europe at this time. So it could be part of that movement, and it could be echoes of a larger consternation. Why it is? Whether or not it's warranted, it's interesting to me that without necessarily knowing it, they're tapping into the same categories of evil, saying this is an egel and that's an egel. It seems to be parallel. It seems to work, be sorted correctly. Correct? Yes.
With one of them, it seems that they're being, the first one, it seems that they're being misdirected. They could be misdirected. But with the second one, it seems that they're, even if that in that first case everything is has good intention, but in the second case it's almost like there's built-in
there's a level of insubordination.
Like the trait that they could be actually trait.
There's definitely an undertone of insubordination with the machine matzah. Why won't they listen to me? I'm writing at the same time again. But but again, it's that trope of they think they've fixed it. They constantly think that they're getting closer and closer to a kosher matzah. No, they're dealing with an egel hazahav. So I agree that perhaps there is a range or a spectrum of different types of egels. But what I want to only in broad strokes understand of what exactly is an egel. I think it'll be very clear that what's an egel is certainly not a malik, and what's a malik is certainly not an egel. But at least the error itself is coming about in a fundamental way. Although there are different trappings to the terrible wanton error.
As you said, there's also this feeling of modernity. If we look and see, boy, there is a lot of idolatry involved with machines and machines taking the place of other things that should be going that way.
Right.
Torah, Levitical, etc.
Interesting. Okay. We turn the page. Actually, on the bottom of page one, you have the Hebrew in Orot of Rav Avram Yitzchak Kohen Cook. And let's just look at the English for a moment, where he too talks about Chita Egel, writing in 1920, reflecting upon the Great War, what would become known as World War I. Were it not for the sin of the golden calf, writes Rav Cook, the inhabitants of the land of Israel would have been reconciled with the people of Israel. If it wasn't for the golden calf, the Jewish people would have had Israel. He's referring to the actual golden calf. If you go down to the third from the bottom line, the ethical suppression by which secular civilization dominates people caused them anxiety and many evil traits. And this is after reflecting on the sin of the golden calf. If you see, even I skipped earlier on. If you look earlier on in another bolded section, it's four lines from the top. Sorry to make you skip around. The sin of the golden sin of the calf will be totally erased. So Rav Cook, in not necessarily the clearest fashion, is calling something secularism a golden calf. What we don't see from this text is that Rav Cook was actually exiled. Rav Cook was away fundraising during World War I. He was not allowed into Israel. He spent most of his time, well, it wasn't known as Israel then, it was known as the British Mandate. Well, it would eventually, after this, be known as the British Mandate. And Rav Cook was in Switzerland and also in England. And Rav Cook was exposed to lots of people of learning. And he understood that World War I, again, not for us to necessarily judge or critique his views, but he called secularism an egel hazahav. It came possibly from a good, but this was a very well-read person. This is somebody who appreciated Rembrandt. In fact, when he visited Rembrandt's paintings when he was exiled in London, he referred to Rembrandt's use of light as the light used by God in creation, the Ora Hagunus. I mean, absolutely a fantastic appreciation had Rav Kook of Rembrandt. He would quote from Immanuel Kant and others. This is somebody who appreciated the best of modern-day philosophy and literature. At the same time, he could never countenance, although he had a very interesting view and his viewpoint of Zionism, nevertheless, his view at this point of secularism was to describe it as an Egel Hazav. It came, perhaps, from a good place, but from a precarious place. Do you know what you're dealing with? And if we're going to quote Rav Kook, we might as well quote the Satmar Rebbe, source 6. Writing in 1967, so which world event had just transpired? Well, all correct.
Six-day war.
Yes, the Six-Day War. Ba'avonotenu harabim. Again, I'm interested in just understanding his rhetorical messaging, not necessarily the content. Ba'avonotenu harabim gam achshav. Nes ha-to'eva hazot b'Yisrael. Now, there's been this terrible to'eva, this terrible disgrace, this mockery, this disgusting thing. What is he talking about? Israel. B'Yisrael, she'esh choshvim. They say that what has just happened, what has just taken place in Israel, were nisim v'niflaot, mamash, nisim Mitzrayim, just like the miracles of Egypt. That's what people were saying after the Six-Day War. V'einam samim alev ki advarim sovvim l'romim koach atuma shal tziyunim. Not to be believed. This is the propaganda, I'm cleaning up the language just a little bit, of the Zionists. Hagru'u'im that are worse than ba'alafim dragot or madregot mea egel hazav. Okay, again, I'm not interested in the content. I mean, I am, but for our purposes, again, I'm one of these people in the room who report to a different authority on religious Zionism. That being said, it's interesting, again, the use of Egel HaZahav. What is Egel HaZahav in this case? Is the army, are the Nisim V'Niflaot, are all of the people who claim, who are in the process of claiming that we saw God's hand. How else do you explain 1967. How do you explain the Egyptian Air Force? It has to be Nisim v'Niflaot. It's like the parting of the sea. It's like the Ten Makot. We're living in a miraculous age, say the Zionists. They're fooling, they're bamboozling the Jewish people, says the Satmar Rebbe. This is not to be understood this way. This is just something 1,000 times worse than Egel HaZahav. Yes?
Are you going to talk about why they love it? I'm trying to understand their perspective of why they would think that is idolatry if you're attributing it to.
That's a tactic. Yeah. What did they say?
What is the Satmar Rebbe saying? You're asking specifically about the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe was no fan of the Zionists. He came from a Hungarian enclave. Right. This is actually not the sharpest thing he ever wrote about the Zionist enterprise. He had written about it previously. Vayol Moshe had already appeared. Which is his most trenchant critique of Zionism. And while I'm introducing it with a sense of caution, I understand how it could be terribly disturbing. Why he thought the way he thought, he was convinced that the Zionist enterprise was responsible for so many things, including perhaps the Shoah.
You know, I didn't mean to ask about that. What I meant was, in general, how could it be seen that attributing the Six-Day War to a mural, you know, that it was miraculous, how that could be seen?
Because they are tripping up, just like the people who conjured up the Egel HaZahav are trying to trip up and mislead, however advertently or inadvertently, the Jewish people. What is the theme? So let's actually take a step back. What is the Egel HaZahav? The Egel HaZahav is either somebody being bullocked, somebody being confused and taking on a course which will eventually lead to some disastrous end, or, and it's really a part of this image, is somebody misleading a larger group, namely the Jewish people, in doing something that they think is good that is actually terribly debilitating. So whether it's machine matzah, where you're going to be introducing chametz to the Seder table, whether it's secularism, where you think you're introducing enlightenment, but really you're just introducing some sort of poison or toxic to Torah, whether it's Zionism or attributing the miracles, it's actually what he's critiquing is not the Six-Day War itself. He's critiquing, again, using Lashon Nekiyah, nice words, he's critiquing the messaging of saying, ha, the religious Zionists are saying, this is proof that we're at the doorstep of the Messianic Age. Look at what just happened, the interpretation. He's not interested in the Six-Day War. He's not denying.
No, but if they're attributing it to Hashem, then it seems like that.
They are attributing it to what comes about with the religious Zionist message, which is we have to all be on board. We have to all give to the, you know, Karen Hayesod and Karen Kayemet. We have to start making Aliyah. We have to support the state. We have to do all of this and that. The prime minister is the king of the Jews. We have to believe in all of that because this is God telling us, get on board, Mashiach is coming. And Israel is the pathway to that era. And what the Satmar Rebbe is suggesting, no. By suggesting that, you are leading the Jewish people down an erroneous path. You are providing for them another Egel HaZahav. They don't need this. Just wait a little bit longer and Moshe will be coming down that mountain, I promise you. That's the message here. Good. Okay.
We're well said.
Yeah. Clear. Okay. Another golden calf moment in source 7, but let's actually skip down because I want to get to Amalek. Let's get to Amalek. Let's turn the page. Where is the first Amalek? Okay, good. No. Let's go to source 8. Source 8. We'll do a sweeping survey of how Amalek is used and see if we can come out with another category of evil. One of the leading students in Toldot Yaakov Yosef of the Baal Shem Tov wrote the following in Parshat Yitro. By the light of wisdom, a soul, this is my translation, is able to cleave to the Creator, to cleave to Hashem, but only after the straightest path is selected. HaOmer ach kasher chanu b'rifidim. That is why when the Israelites encamped in Rifidim and loosened their connection to Torah, Amalek arrived. Az, in the Hebrew, vayavo Amalek shehu hayetzer hara. So from the earliest of Hasidic sources, what is Amalek? Amalek is more than just a person. Amalek is more than just a nation. Amalek is an idea. It's an evil idea that you have to root out. And that is the thesis, that is the hypothesis that we're going to test in a couple of sources. Whereas Egel HaZahav is misguidedness, Egel HaZahav is clear and blatant evil that we have to smoke out.
So the straightest path is what?
where they wanted to take the straightest path, and they didn't. And we can talk about it afterwards. Good question. Source 9.
So again, it's selective, so that's like the conflict. You choose evil.
Correct.
You choose the path.
Correct. Correct. But you're choosing a blatant evil. The reason I pass, source 9, on the opportunity to offer, this is Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, to offer this blessing is because I once heard from my teacher, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Diskin, that he possessed a tradition from the Gaon of Vilna that the germination is derived from a malik. So this is why the student and all the others did not greet Kaiser. The indicators when he came to Jerusalem. The indicators of a malik are glorification and beautification of the superficial. Inside, they are full of venom and preoccupied and have preoccupied hatred for Israel. How then can one bless the leader of this nation, Kaiser Wilhelm II, with God's name? So why didn't a certain cadre of rabbinic leaders, when Kaiser Wilhelm visited Jerusalem, why didn't they come out to greet him and make a bracha on a melech? Don't do that for Germany, is what he did. And this is in 1898. Why? Because they represent superficial beautification. Okay. Next source, source 10. Vachanan Wasserman, who would be killed tragically by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, wrote the following. V'hine katuv, milchama la'Hashem ba'amalek midor dor. We fight against Amalek in all generations. The Torah testifies that this war will persist until the Messianic age. We're never going to stop Amalek. It is an ideological battle, claims Rav Chanan Wasserman. However, in the instances of the earlier generations, the Jewish people possessed Torah. So the seed of Amalek remained within the Gentile nations. It's a seed. It's an idea. It's not a person. Once the yoke of Torah was removed from the Jewish people, the seed of Amalek infected Jewish ranks and festered along with spiteful heresy. For example, who's Amalek in this case? The communists, who were found in our regions and beyond, in all dispersed Jewish communities. There were many Jews who, of course, were communists. And communism, therefore, becomes the spirit of Amalek. We have to destroy it. Source 11. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. In Divrei Hashkafa, and he really puts it in its pithiest form. Amalek is the essence of evil and injustice, a human devil. My father would say in the name of his father that he who optimizes Amalek is the type of wickedness that affirms, quoting the Pasuk in Tehillim, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. Remember, more than this, there is no substantive difference between all of the various articulations of this sort of evil and hatred for the Jewish people. So it's not just any type of conceptual evil, but evil that's pointed at the Jewish people in the Rav's mind. There was an element that was animated to act in a socio-political manner. Some of that maintained influence as a progressive element, while another carried impact in a conservative milieu. Some identified as atheistic, while others as religiously fanatic. There are many forms of Amalek. It's not just one type. It's any type that at its core is no good. The character of the satanic Amalek perseveres, regardless of the various challenges that confront society and life. And finally, in source 12, Menachem Begin, then a Knesset member in 1951, arguing against receiving war reparations from Germany, says, how can you possibly, he says to David Ben-Gurion's government, accept money from not just Nazis, but a Malik, says that before Knesset. So it's pretty consistent, right? Interestingly, the Rav, when referring to communism, referred to them as Paro. I think that was up in elsewhere. So he had a different type for communism, which is interesting. So what do we see? What is the takeaway? How do we close this? It seems pretty consistent that without, certainly all these rabbinic writers, not huddled together, lived in different places and at different times, all intuited the same conceptual image of various forms of evil. This is an ego, that's an amalek. Something else is a molech, something else is a paro, another thing is a yetzer hara, but the two towering forms of absolute atrocious evil are ego and amalek. One is just conceptually through and through evil, the other one is misguided but leads to absolute travesty. They both lead you in the same path. Yes?
Well, it seems that one is internal and one is external, within and outside the Jewish.
Which one is?
The egg would be more internal.
In the egg?
Internal danger.
Okay, with the caveat that Rochanan Wasserman certainly was very concerned that Jews were becoming card-carrying members of the Communist Party. But you're right, there is this sense, well, even in the Hasidic interpretation, it's the Yetzer Hara, so there is more room to say Amalek is foreign. After all, in the biblical narrative, Egal HaZahav came from within, whereas Amalek certainly came from without. So so prima facie, from the very outset, you would be more inclined to suggest that Amalek is much more foreign evil and Egal is much more internal. Which is interesting, I haven't thought about that. It's a very good point, thank you. Any other points? Why do you think it is? We've tested it again. Well, we ran through about 12 sources, good sources, but certainly not exhaustive. There could be more, but we started to test the hypothesis that rabbinic writers in Jewish memory has decided to sort different types of calamity, different types of warning signs into biblical categories. An egel versus an amalek. And without, again, I'll use that image again, huddling together on a football field, drawing up a play, they just said, they intuited that this ought to be this category and this ought to be the other. Again, as we point out, that each usage has its own caveats, its own particularities that are different, perhaps from one another, but at their core they remain the same. Why is that so? And why do they look to Tanakh? Why did it not just to Tanakh? Forget about the Nun and the Chav, to Torah, to the Bible, to understand evil. Why does Jewish memory require a Torah lens, a Torah framework? I don't mean that in a frum sense. I mean that in terms of how we speak. That we have to understand our current situation through categories that were already determined by the Torah. Does that make sense? And it is impossible, therefore, to separate Jewish history and Jewish memory from that all-important sacred text. That all of these documents and how Jews use their speech, use their words over time, becomes a non sequitur without the Torah. The Torah is that link. It's how we have formulated our thoughts, our visions, our creative minds have only been creative insofar as they can be anchored in Torah typologies. We need that. Without it, there's the conduits, the connector devices don't seem to hold any longer.
You're saying not from Tanakh, but from Purim.
There are probably cases where Nach, and certainly give the example of Purim, There is a Mordechai and Esther. There's another lecture, another hypothesis to be really formulated about what over time becomes an Esther and a Mordechai. Who becomes a Judah the Maccabee? Who becomes a Yirmiyahu? And so I think that you could probably, in maybe less pronounced ways, look at how we formulate ideas and thoughts and writing with all sorts of different characters and categories. These are more pronounced because evil seems to always befall.
Even their characters are traced back to the formative characters of Chumash. So that
correct. And you absolutely correct. Esther becomes a Yosef character, and perhaps there is too. Maybe there is a certain level of repetitiveness, and we have to go there. That Esther becomes an echo of Yosef, not personally, but from an image point of view. And Chazal were wont to do that to the historical actors in Nevi'im and Ketuvim. You're absolutely right. So maybe it would be safe to say the baseline, sort of the primordial soup of how we sort of widget together our own ideas have to be based somewhere in Chumash. That's just how a faith community unfolds over time. I say unfold rather than unravel. How would it unravel if we didn't have that energy source?
I think in the same way, Paro or Haman, Haman, well, he was the Amalek, because then very clearly, you know, Paro drowned all the males and Haman wanted to kill all the Jews. Then definitely, I think, was the Amalek. Amalek was just following Yaakov and, you know, killed the ones who were strangled
right.
in the bed.
Right.
But Paro and Haman is very clearly.
Right. Okay, so there's work to do. Thank you all very, very much for coming.